Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. American Girl unveils its newest doll, Melody Ellison, an African-American girl from Detroit of the 1960s.
Melody's older sister goes south to be part of the civil rights movement. So they wanted to give a much broader sense of the struggle and the changes that took place and the ordinary people who were involved in those changes.
How a doll can teach us lessons about the civil rights era. But first, Donald Trump is coming back to Michigan, his second visit in as many weeks. It's a sign that Michigan matters to the Republican presidential candidate. He'll speak at a rally at the Summit Sports and Ice Complex in Diamonddale in Eaton County. With us now is the chair of the Eaton County Republican Party, Bruce Barland. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you, Cindy.
How and when, Bruce, did you find out that Mr. Trump was coming to Eaton County?
I think it was Monday or Tuesday, maybe.
So pretty short notice.
Yeah, well, I've had people call me asking, you know, questions about it, and I have called some of the staff. I know a couple of them, you know, if people wanted to volunteer to help, and apparently he's got some pretty good staff rounded up because apparently they don't need much help, which is a great thing.
Were you surprised, Bruce, to find out that he was going to come to Eaton County?
I was surprised, but I really think it's a great choice on his part because Eaton County is a great county. It's easy to get to. The Summit's very easy to get to from, you know, Grand Rapids, Detroit area. It's really in a great, great position.
Bruce, what do you think it means to people in Eaton County, particularly Republicans in Eaton County, to have such a high-profile campaign visit? Not Detroit, not Grand Rapids, but in Diamonddale.
Oh, I think it's terrific. I have just had so many people in our area that have really been surprised and, like I say, willing to help and excited about Mr. Trump coming here.
We have certainly, speaking nationally, seen some very visible divisions within the Republican Party over whether or not to support Mr. Trump. First of all, do you support him?
Absolutely.
And have you seen divisions within Eaton County Republicans over supporting Mr. Trump? And if you have, how have you handled that?
I think they've handled it mostly on their own because they see where the country and the state is going, and they really, 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 really are beginning to know and understand that Trump has a plan that's going to work to make America better and get it back on the course that it needs to be great again.
What do you hear from him, Bruce, as far as what do you see as that plan? What policy positions of Mr. Trump's really resonate with you?
I like the idea of him doing things to try to get Americans working again in America, making things that Americans want to buy and can be sold for a price that Americans and people around the world can afford to pay. He wants to get rid of a lot of these useless regulations, a lot of the high taxes on businesses and business owners that drive the prices and costs of goods sold up to Americans so that it makes it harder and harder to buy American products.
So the jobs and the economy really resonate with you. There are people that still are searching for what the plan is. They hear the bumper stickers and hear him say, we're going to do this, but not so much on the how. Are you hearing enough of a how where you do feel that you know what the plan is?
I really don't know all the intricacies of the plan. But the ideas that I have heard from him about cutting taxes, cutting regulations, and those types of things do make a lot of sense to me because every time you raise taxes on a business, you increase regulations on a business, and the cost of the regulation gets passed on to the consumer. When those costs and regulations reach the point where the consumer can no longer afford to buy that company's product, that company has no choice. They're pretty much done. And when they're done, the people that work for that company are done too. So that's, to me, the economic part of it has to be, and I think he's hitting on it, you know, the useless regulations, the regulations that really don't matter, and the excessive taxation on businesses need to be cut. And I think he's the man to do it.
Bruce, there is a good chunk of voters still looking at everything, trying to figure out who will I vote for come November. And these undecided voters, see inconsistencies and controversies over things Donald Trump says or tweets, like intimating a Muslim Gold Star mother was not allowed to speak at the Democratic convention, or the tweet where he said he got a letter from the NFL about the timing of the upcoming debates and the NFL said, we never sent him a letter, or calling President Obama the founder of ISIS. How do you, in your mind, reconcile these and other statements that Mr. Trump has made that are not true?
Personally, those are fairly minor topics. They just seem so minor compared to what Hillary has been saying and the Benghazi hearings and her making, I don't know, how many millions of dollars a year in speaking engagements. And Hillary has said so many more and more serious, outrageous statements, you know, in the past 15 years, 20 years, and done more things that are wrong. I believe her statements are much, 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 much worse.
Tomorrow, when Mr. Trump is right there in Diamonddale, right there in your county, what are you hoping you can say to him?
Well, good afternoon. Keep up the great work, and let's get the right things done for America.
Bruce Barland is the chair of the Republican Party in Eaton County, where Donald Trump will be there speaking at a rally tomorrow afternoon in Diamonddale. Bruce Barland, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, you're welcome, Cindy. Thank you.
This week, Ford announced it's joining forces with four tech companies and doubling its staff in Silicon Valley. The goal, a fully self-driving vehicle by 2021. No steering wheel, no brake, no gas pedal. Randy Vicentainer directs Ford's autonomous vehicle program. He spoke to Stateside Wednesday.
We see autonomous vehicles as expanding over time. This isn't just a single event.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. At Move by Ford, a sign it, as you wrote in today's column, Daniel, your father's auto industry is gone and it's not coming back.
No, I got to tell you, Cynthia, I've been so impressed by particularly General Motors and Ford this year, to a lesser extent FCA, in the way they're leaning forward into this mobility game. These companies are really performing well in the traditional car and truck business, making a lot of money, selling a lot of vehicles. But at the same time, they're making some really big bets and leaning forward in the mobility space. And I think clearly trying to send a message first to Wall Street and secondly to Silicon Valley that we are not going to cede the next generation of transportation to you guys. And we're going to be a player here. And I think it's a very, very encouraging sign about the sophistication of management, its willingness to take calculated risks, and understanding that they have to do that at the same time that they do the traditional business.
And yet Wall Street shrugged after Ford made that announcement. Why?
Because I think there is some very deep skepticism among investors that anything that smacks of Detroit and autos doesn't have growth, doesn't have innovation, and has a very long history of being slow and plodding and risk-averse. And if you look at the history of the industry, that's not unfair, particularly in the last, in the last generation for sure. It's only been in the last few years as they've come out of the meltdown that these companies have shown a much more nimble approach, a much better business model with the help in part, of course, of American taxpayers during the bailout and the bankruptcy. But I think there's a lot of figurative hands on the hips kind of show me. Show us that you can do this. It's fine for you to make these bets in mobility when you're making record profits in North America. But when things get a little tougher, are you going to be able to sustain both your product portfolio, your product investment, your manufacturing, your design, at the same time that you continue to get smart in the mobility space? And so I think there's a lot of wait and see. My own view, having covered this industry really for a generation all over the world, is I've never seen them behaving this way consistently. And I think it's very encouraging. And I think people listening to the show ought to be encouraged and think, you know, we need more of this. You guys got to keep it up, because this market that we're in is not going to continue ad infinitum. It is going to slow down. It's already showing signs of slowing down,
right?
And it's going to be a little tougher going forward.
And leaning in and leaning forward, as you say, into the mobility space, that matters so much to the people who rely on these companies for wages or retirement benefits and for the supply base and, as you point out, for the economic health of Michigan.
One of the reasons I wrote that piece was number one was, of course, Ford's announcement this week, but also was a tone I was getting in reaction to some other things I was writing. And there's a tone out there that this isn't for real. This is a joke. Who's going to buy autonomous cars or semi-autonomous cars? That mobility is not real. It's not going to happen. Not enough people are going to do it. And yet my daughter, who lives in Washington, is constantly moving around the city in Uber. As long as she lives there, I don't see her, unless and until she gets married and has a family, I don't see her buying a car. She doesn't need one. And, I mean, that's just one micro example. And there's an awful lot of people that are using Uber in urban spaces, and I think that's what's first going to change. It's not going to be the farmers and the contractors that buy pickups. That's not going to change right now. But it is going to be younger people that look at this and say, hey, you know what, I don't need to own a car. And we're already seeing evidence that young people in general don't feel the need like I did when I was young to get that license, to get that first car, to get a set of wheels. They have other priorities. And the car companies have to look at this stuff. And if they don't, it'll be like the same old story about Detroit. They missed the opportunity. They thought they understood, and they lose the opportunity going forward. And I think the fact that they're doing this is really smart.
And Silicon Valley is right there ready to be part of that. So as you say, this is the year Detroit digs in and says, we're not giving in to this mobility game to Silicon Valley.
That's right. Whatever the social justice piousness that comes from entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, the reality is they are cutthroat capitalists, and they are looking at Detroit and the automotive space as really a trifecta: profitability, growth, and opportunity. And that's how they've become Silicon Valley. And they're looking at this opportunity here, and they're going to go after it. And I think these guys here in Detroit, and frankly in other parts of the world in the global industry, are trying to answer that challenge.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with us via Skype. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on Stateside, 1 or 2 week mission trips to, let's say, Haiti or Mexico. They've gotten more popular. But if you go on one, are you really helping? We'll take a closer look at voluntourism. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. For over 20 years, volunteers with AmeriCorps have served in nonprofits, schools, public agencies, and community and faith-based groups all across the country. And it turns out, Michigan is one of the top states for AmeriCorps volunteers. Here with us is Bill Basil, National Director of AmeriCorps. Bill, to get an appreciation of what Michigan's role is in AmeriCorps, tell us what the members do. What is AmeriCorps?
Well, AmeriCorps is our nation's national service program. It began about 22 years ago, and it provides individuals opportunities to make a concrete, positive contribution to their community. And what I mean by that, for instance, most of our AmeriCorps members serve in the education area, and so you'd find many of our members serving in schools, in elementary schools. They're the ones that help kids who are struggling with reading. And why reading? Well, because we know that that's the building block upon which academic success is built. And we know that after they learn to read, they'll be reading to learn.
And there's a lot of other areas that AmeriCorps volunteers serve in outside of education.
They do. And we have large numbers of members who serve in disaster response. We have over 300 now deployed to Louisiana who are serving there because of the terrible flooding. In Detroit, we have excellent, outstanding program, the Detroit Urban Safety Corps, where we have over 40 members who are supported and sponsored by Wayne State University, who are working and serving in 8 neighborhoods in Detroit, where we're seeing a documented 44% reduction in crime because of the work these AmeriCorps members who are recruited from these neighborhoods are doing. It is a national model, and so we're seeing a lot of positive activities taking place, not only in schools, but in the community at large.
How do you go about identifying needs and then matching volunteers with those needs?
Well, AmeriCorps is a very decentralized program. In other words, we in Washington, D.C. don't identify the needs. Those are identified locally. It's ground up, and it's based on local need. And one, if you see one AmeriCorps program, you've seen one AmeriCorps program. Our programs are different because the needs are different in communities around the country.
And where is Michigan in the rankings of AmeriCorps volunteers?
They're in the top 20 as a state. Detroit ranks number 9 in terms of large cities. But we're finding that in Detroit, because of the large numbers of folks who are being engaged and involved, 2 years ago we had that terrible flooding in Detroit, large numbers of members serving there. We're seeing large numbers of folks who, for whom this is something about what it means to live in the new Detroit, if you will, and to be able to serve and be counted upon and make a positive contribution. And we also have individuals who are interested in using service as a strategy to make a positive contribution. So, for instance, in Flint, we have been engaged in Flint long before the water crisis, and now we will have AmeriCorps members serving in every school. Every school this September will have AmeriCorps members serving in Flint to help address the students and children who are struggling and try to ensure that they have a positive and high-quality education experience.
How does AmeriCorps ensure that volunteers that come into an area are really, truly making a difference, that they aren't just parachuting in and working for a while and then zipping back home?
We rely largely on the host site, the local organizations who apply to us to ensure that, A, the right kind of member is recruited that will have the stick-to-itiveness, if you will, that will be able to stay the complete term of service, the full year. Secondly, they are responsible for doing the training. Every AmeriCorps member receives training in roughly 20% of their time. And AmeriCorps is devoted to training and development. And so we hope that prioritizing that, those kinds of opportunities enables individuals to, if you will, take very seriously what they're signing up to do, and that the commitment is there, and that the ability to stay and build and create a new neighborhood or new community is also part of that experience.
When the service is done, when that year is done, what have you seen, how have you seen the AmeriCorps experience coming home with that volunteer?
It comes in different ways. We're fond of saying that the AmeriCorps commitment is for 1 year, but the experience of AmeriCorps lasts a lifetime. And we see that in terms of individuals who take on various responsibilities. We have AmeriCorps members who serve in a variety of capacities as elected officials. We have an AmeriCorps member who is a United States Senator. We have AmeriCorps members who serve in business and industry. And I think the other feature that we look at are the skill sets that AmeriCorps members acquire as part of AmeriCorps, and they know that because of these experiences, they will be a highly prized employee.
Bill, do we have a head count as you recognize Michigan as one of the states producing the most AmeriCorps volunteer members? Do we know how many Michigan has produced?
Yes. Since 1994, just over 28,000 individuals from Michigan have joined AmeriCorps, and they have contributed over 41 million hours of service and earned just over $92 million of education awards that they can use to help further their post-secondary education or pay off student loans.
Bill Basil is the National Director of AmeriCorps. Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
You're welcome, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
Would you be willing to take a vacation centered around helping, perhaps through a church group or a school group, maybe teaching English, maybe building a school in a struggling country? It's called voluntourism. Intentions are good, but the results, they might not be as helpful as the voluntourists are hoping for. Good intentions misplaced?
Well, let's talk about the problems inherent in voluntourism and how churches, schools, and organizations can pivot away from that surface-level voluntourism model and move toward a community-engaged, deeper investment with communities and with people. Mary Jo Callen is here with us, director of the Edward Ginsberg Center for Community Service and Learning at the University of Michigan. Hello, Mary Jo.
Hello, Cynthia.
Good to have you with us. And from West Michigan, we get to say hello to Christy Gleason, who's Senior Director of Global Programs at Bethany Global. Hello, Christy.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. I want to start by understanding the work that you both do. Christy, what is your mission at Bethany Global?
To bring and keep families together. So our main goal really is getting children that have been either separated from their families or have lost their parents either due to war or other issues, and placing them into what we call alternative family-based care, which is foster care, kinship care, programs like that.
Within the countries, within their home countries.
Correct.
And Mary Jo Callen, what does the Ginsberg Center do?
To cultivate community relationships and connect community needs, resources, and interests to faculty and student talents at the University of Michigan.
On the ground, that would mean what? I'm a student and I might want to spend my break doing something. Would you then try to connect me with a worthy program?
Yes, we definitely connect lots of students who have great intentions and want to do good in the world. We also help faculty who want to infuse that methodology of community engagement into their courses, help them do that in a thoughtful, authentic, and respectful way.
And what we're talking about here is local, it's national, and it's international, correct?
Correct.
Absolutely.
Give me a sense of how, when I talk about voluntourism, what does it mean to you, Mary Jo?
Voluntourism to us really connotes a frame of mind, frankly, that is often folks with relative privilege and power, whether or not they feel it day to day, who have great intentions and take time, which is great, to help save, fix those who are less fortunate, less well off than themselves. We applaud the intent. How it often gets played out, though, is thinking of folks who are marginalized or who are economically less well off as subjects, as objects, as less than. We really try to help students, faculty, and others who want to work with us be more thoughtful in how they engage and think about the community, as frankly, just like us.
And Christy, how about you? What is your characterization of voluntourism?
We've seen a very large increase in the number of people who are coming to Bethany Christian Services and Bethany Global wanting to have a deeper, more intimate relationship with the work that they want to do. They don't want to just be tourists. They want to go and they want to give back. They want to be a part of something that's bigger than themselves.
So that's very laudable.
It's great intentions. It's great. And I think the idea of voluntourism in its pure concept is actually a really good idea. I want to go, and I don't want to just take from a culture or from a community that I'm visiting. I want to be able to give back. With intentions being great, I think that's a great idea. The problem becomes where there's not such a great fit between the skill set of the people going overseas and the issues and the needs of the community in which they've been placed. How do we appropriately offer opportunities for people to come and work in our programs overseas where we keep children safe, where we keep the volunteers safe, but have an impact and a sustainable change that can be created in a relatively short amount of time.
Mary Jo, can this kind of help that we're describing, the more surface level, let me go in for a couple of weeks and I'll help build a school someplace that I think needs it. How can that actually be more damaging to a community than helpful?
Well, I want to be clear that sometimes it can be helpful.
Yes.
There is sometimes a place for all range of helping. I think where we see it is less helpful and sometimes even damaging is we see it in a couple of ways. Mm-hmm. One, often we decide, we as the volunteers or the voluntourists or the organizer of the voluntourism decides what the community needs are, what the project will be, and really sort of some folks sort of talk about it as benevolent invasion. We decide how it's going to be. We then impose our view of it that often is from very far away or certainly not really deeply engaged in understanding what the community needs or ever asking them what the need is. That's one way it can be damaging. It takes time on the ground, whether it's an organization, a neighborhood, a community group. It takes time for them to help support those volunteers who are doing the project. you know, one way is just we decide how it's going to be without ever asking. And then, you know, from our perspective and certainly thinking about it from a student education lens, what are the takeaways? Who gets to decide? Who gets to be a part of decision making in our communities, in this world? And how do we change students, again, well-intentioned, very conscientious, but limited experience and notions about how we engage in a sustainable community?
Christy, Bethany Global uses a community-engaged model. You kind of started to describe that. Take us a little deeper and tell us what that means.
The way that we build our programs is very much from the ground up. So we have a model of foster care, a model of family-based care that gets children out of orphanages and off the streets into foster families in the countries that they live in. We have a model that's been developed here in the States. However, it's been piloted now in 8 countries. But when we start a program in a country, we hire local staff. We have country directors who are working very much in partnership with local government, local resources, the local church, in order to build a program that is, one, appropriate for the children that we're trying to serve, but also that fits into the community as it is. So while I have oversight and sort of monitor how the program is going, all of the day-to-day decisions, the programs that are being done, the trainings that are being held are all done in the community by people of that local community.
On that local level that you work in through the Ginsburg Center, Mary Jo, I can hear you say it is so crucial to avoid that appearance of the helper coming in to help the less privileged, that appearance of I know what's best for you. How do you guard against that as you determine where to place volunteers?
We spend a lot of our time thinking about that and making sure that we create authentic, reciprocal, mutually beneficial relationships. So how do we do it? When we talk with university actors, whether that's students, faculty, staff, who want to do good, it's starting from a good intention, we ask them to think about some questions. One, how do they know what the need is in the community? Have they asked? And often that's why they come to us. So what we do is we make sure that we're actually taking an outside-in approach to community engagement, community engaged learning, teaching, and research. We spend a lot of time going into communities, into neighborhoods, into networks to ask, what are the needs? And bring those needs back to the university. So it's really doing a 180 on the approach we often take, which is we come up with good ideas and we go find a community partner to help. This is taking really talented folks who want to do good and sharing with them, here are the high impact opportunities that the community has identified that they need. You know, it's so obvious. You ask, what do you need? Whether you're working, whether you're a student, whether you're a community member, whether you're part of a church group,
yes,
and you want to help, start by asking. Start by listening to what the community, whatever that community is. There's obviously the community is not a monolith. Find out what are the issues you're interested in? What are the deeper root causes of those issues? That's another thing we think a lot about and help our students and folks who are working with us think through. Before you engage, learn about the issue. Learn about the cause of the issue so that in 50 years, maybe it won't be an issue. And then be willing to hear what is actually needed, because how you want to volunteer, how you want to engage may not be what is needed. To Christy's earlier point, you may not have the specialized skills that are needed in a particular setting. Listen to that partner, listen to that community group, and plug in how they need you to.
Because I bet in some cases, rather than somebody coming down and who's never done it before, trying to lift bricks and help build something, write a check. It may not feel the same, but the money that you might spend on this could be used in the community. So you really do have to listen. Christy, what do you want to add to that?
Being open to what is actually needed. Lots of people want to go and they want to have this impact and they want to be a part of things. And maybe there's an opportunity that's really, really appropriate, such as building a house or, you know, moving bricks or stones. But especially in an international context, the issues and huge barriers that our communities are facing are very complex. And so it's a lot more difficult to sort of jump in, be there for 2 or 3 weeks, and then sort of jump out and really still have an impact in a sustained manner. I love that idea of being open to what's actually needed. We spend a lot of time having conversations and trainings with our interns that we do send overseas to that exact point. What really is necessary? What really is needed? And then being open to what the people on the ground are telling you. Yes, you want to maybe go and do one thing, but if that's not going to help anybody, then you have to put that aside, put your expectations to one side, put your cultural understandings sort of away to really be open to what really is needed. I think that's probably the best way to enter into communications about voluntourism is, are you, as a person who wants to do a project like that, are you open to being asked to do something that maybe you weren't thinking that you would you would want to do.
So it sounds like step one is kind of check your ego at the door and kind of then step through and see what you see.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yes.
Interesting thoughts from Christy Gleason of Bethany Global in West Michigan and Mary Jo Callen, director of the Edward Ginsberg Center for Community Service and Learning at the University of Michigan, on voluntourism. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still ahead on Stateside, Michigan joins forces with Ontario to boost our mutual auto industries. Then an inside look at just what went into designing the newest American Girl doll. Her name is Melody, and she's from 1960s Detroit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The ties between Michigan and Ontario just got stronger. Governor Snyder and Ontario's Premier Kathleen Wynne recently signed an agreement that sets up an alliance between the auto industries of Michigan and Ontario. Here with us now is the Ontario Minister of Economic Growth and Alliance, Brad Duguid. It's great to have you with us.
Great to join you, Cindy.
There was this choice, wasn't there? Ontario and Michigan could compete with each other or work together.
Well, I don't think it's as black and white quite as that. There's no question Governor Snyder and Premier Wynne recognize that from time to time there'll still be some competition within our cluster. But when we join forces, we are among the most powerful regions in the world when it comes to auto production. We're much more powerful, we're much stronger, much more able to sustain growth in our cluster if we work together. So I think it's a very smart decision on behalf of the governor and premier to join forces and work together.
What do you see as Ontario's main strengths and weaknesses in the auto industry?
Well, we're very similar to Michigan in that we have higher staffing costs in terms of wages than some of the, you know, Mexico and maybe the southern U.S. It's challenging to compete on that basis. At the same time, though, we're the center of innovation when it comes to innovation in auto. Between Michigan and Ontario, we're really the leaders in that area. In Ontario, we have the lowest effective corporate tax rate in North America. We have a really good workforce, both in Michigan and Ontario, that's experienced. And the fact is, when you put Michigan and Ontario together, even separately, we both individually lead North America in terms of national jurisdictions in producing vehicles. Together, we produce by far more vehicles than they do in Mexico or anywhere else in North America. So we have some fantastic competitive advantages. And working together, I think we can ensure that we continue to have a strong auto cluster between the province of Ontario and state of Michigan.
As we look at how this alliance can help auto industries on both sides of the border, what would this alliance look like at the ground level? What are we going to be doing that we weren't before?
Well, our auto industry globally is in a state of absolute technological disruption. All auto companies are striving to try to lead that disruption, which is where they need to be. And that means be leaders in connected cars, in autonomous vehicles, in lightweighting of vehicles and alternative fuels. Michigan has a lot of good work being done in R&D on that side of the border. And Ontario is seen, in particular in the ICT area, as second to the Silicon Valley. So when you combine the work that's being done and the talent right now that exists in developing this disruptive technology in both Ontario and Michigan, you've got a very strong innovation ecosystem. And I would suggest any auto company in the world would be negligent not to have a very big footprint in both Ontario and Michigan to ensure that they're at the cutting edge as well on this disruptive technology.
What kind of cooperation will we be seeing?
I think there's a number of areas. Working together to advance new technologies is an area where we can cooperate very readily. We all have our scientific community. We all have our universities and colleges that are very active in this area. And we have our organizations that are helping to drive commercialization, as well as companies. All working together to advance technologies is a way that we can stay out in front of the global movement. But we also have a really impressive supply chain in Ontario and Michigan. And that supply chain doesn't see the borders. They supply parts to vehicles being made in Michigan and vehicles being made in Ontario. So what we want to do is make it as easy for them to be as competitive as they can within our cluster and continue to lower their costs where we can. And ease of crossing the border, for instance, is really important to them because they say the average vehicle sees parts cross the border about 7 times before it's built between Ontario and Michigan. So that kind of cooperation helps. Just as importantly, as the world changes and as the auto market becomes fiercely globally competitive, exchanging best practices between the two jurisdictions and strategic opportunities for us to work together to promote the Great Lakes cluster is something that we can do better together than we can separately. So I'm very excited about this MOU because I think it's got potential to lead to a much stronger auto sector in both Michigan and Ontario.
It was quite an eye-opener when I was reading the joint op-ed by Governor Snyder and Premier Wynne in the Detroit News, where they note that more two-way trade flows across the border between Ontario and Michigan than across any other border in the entire NAFTA zone.
Absolutely. I mean, we are a very strong economic entity, and with the governor and the premier recognizing that through this MOU, it really does, I think, send out a message to the rest of North America that the Great Lakes auto cluster is here, that we can compete with anyone, and that we are, in fact, the strongest auto cluster in all of North America and one of the strongest in the world.
This spirit of kind of cooperation and realizing what we can do working together, we've seen that already at play in putting together the start of the Gordie Howe International Bridge, haven't we?
Well, I had the privilege on behalf of Ontario of extending condolences directly to the Howe family when Gordie Howe passed away, a personal hero of mine. I'm Canadian, of course. My heroes are all hockey players. But I can't think of a better name for that bridge than the Gordie Howe Bridge. And that project is so important to the state of Michigan's auto sector and Ontario's auto sector. And we're pleased that the government of Canada and the government of Ontario have stepped up big time to fund this. And we're okay going it more or less alone in terms of the funding because it's so important to us.
If you and I were to be here talking about this alliance, this new auto alliance between Ontario and Michigan, let's say in 10 years, what would you hope we'd be talking about? What will we be saying?
Well, my hope would be that we would be seen as one of the auto clusters in the world that got out ahead of the disruptive technology move so that we continue to be growing, continue to sustain the very significant level of production we have in automobiles, but also leading to the next generation of transportation. You know, we see Michigan as our sister state. We have the capability of being global leaders and doing that separately, but I think we have a much better chance to get where we need to go if we work together.
Brad Duguid is Ontario's Minister of Economic Development and Growth. Minister, it was great to have you with us on Stateside. Thank you so very much.
Anytime, Cindy. Thank you.
Can a doll teach us valuable history lessons? Lessons about prejudice and the push for civil rights? This weekend, American Girl will unveil its newest doll in Detroit. Her name is Melody Ellison. She is from Detroit in the 1960s. Melody Ellison is American Girl's newest historical character. In developing this doll, American Girl turned to a 6-member advisory board, including my guest, Dr. Gloria House. She is a professor emerita of African American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, a veteran of the civil rights fight. She joined, among others, the late Julian Bond, Juanita Moore of Detroit's Charles H. Wright Museum, and Joanne Watson of the Detroit NAACP in advising and reviewing all stages of developing Melody. Dr. Gloria House, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. House, why did you agree to be on the advisory board?
I was really, well, first of all, I was taken aback to be invited to be on a project developing a doll. But once they explained what they were going to do, and I could see the relevance of what I might be able to contribute, I was happy to do it.
And when they explained that, what they wanted to do and what their goal was, how did they describe that to you? What's the goal?
They wanted to tell the story of actually a family in Detroit, but through that family and through specifically the character of Melody, they really wanted to convey what it was like to be alive and part of the changes that were brought about during the 60s. And they decided they wanted to set the story in Detroit because they could illustrate several things. They could show that there was necessity for a civil rights movement in Detroit because racism was very much in effect and certain discriminatory practices were very strong in Detroit. But also they could show the connection between what was going on in the Southern civil rights movement and Detroit by showing the family connections, the fact that Melody's family, father and mother were in Detroit because their family had left the South in search of a better life. And they also were able to make the connection that Melody's older sister goes South to be part of the civil rights movement. So they wanted to give a much broader sense of the struggle and the changes that took place and the ordinary people who were involved in those changes.
Dr. House, talk to us about the process of designing Melody, not just her story, but her look. American Girl really wanted to get this right?
They really did, and they worked hard at it, and we worked with them, and they convinced us very early on that they wanted to get it right. We had several meetings with various members of the American Girl staff. There were sessions when we talked specifically about how Melody was going to look. What she was going to wear, what her clothes would be like. And the staff at American Girl were involved in really extensive research about clothing and fashion of the period and what a little girl might wear, what would a little girl's jumpsuit look like, what would her pajamas look like, what would her play clothes look like. And we were brought into all of that. They would come to meetings with boards, with cutouts, images from all these possibilities that we were asked to review. And fortunately, former council member, I should call Honorable Joanne Watson,
yes,
you know, was a child in Detroit and remembers, you know, so much of that cultural life of the city. So she was really able to help us a lot.
Dr. House, when you think of her look, how did you as a group decide what had to be right in terms of her skin color, her hair? There's so much nuance there, isn't there?
There is. There's a great deal of nuance there. Because in the United States and throughout the Western world, you know how the Western standard of beauty prevails, right? That is European, Euro-American standards of beauty. That means fair skin, straight hair, etc. So when we were choosing the skin color and hair for the doll, we were really concerned about making sure that the children for whom the doll was being made would be able to identify with her, see themselves as part of the life they were creating around her. So we looked at dolls with various face molds. We looked at dolls with various complexion tones, and we finally settled on the one that everybody will see in Melody. It's a nice, rich brown color. As to her hair, there was a great deal of controversy among the board, advisory board members on the hair. Mostly, we wanted hair that could be braided because most little girls of 9 years old, most African-American girls, would wear their hair braided or plaited, as we say. Mm-hmm. So we wanted that. We wanted braids with maybe ribbons on them or whatever. And we didn't want the hair very, very long because really, really long hair is not an average, doesn't occur as an average among African-American girls. Well, that was a problem. The American Girl staff explained to us that for a doll, hair is really important, and they taught us a term, playability, right? The hair had to have playability. the little girls had to be able to make hairdos and arrange it and whatever and whatever. So we came to something of a consensus. The texture of her hair is representative, or at least attempts to represent, African-American hair, but it is straight for its playability. It can be braided, it can be plaited. Little girls will be able to have a good time with their hairdos. But it would have been wonderful if we could have gone without the long sweep of hair.
Mm.
But you needed a certain length in order to have that playability. The other thing is that, you know, speaking about historical authenticity, during the period, most African-American women were still straightening our hair at the time. So the period for afros, the natural hairstyles, comes a little bit like in later into the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
When more
yep.
and more people were starting, more and more black women were starting to wear our hair natural.
Dr. Angela Davis comes to mind when she exploded.
And also, there is a character in the Melody story, Melody's older sister, who comes home from college wearing a natural. So there's an attempt in the story to reflect that change as well, that African-American women were beginning to think about themselves differently and not feeling so burdened by trying to approximate the Euro-American standards of beauty.
I know that Melody and her family's story represents Detroit in the mid-1960s. So what do you want the girls of 2016 who will be given a Melody Ellison doll, what do you want them to learn about race and discrimination and also about that Detroit of the 60s?
Well, I want them to read the books as well. I hope their parents will buy the books as well as the doll. I want them to learn from Melody that even as young people, as very young girls, they can understand what the struggle for social justice is about, the concern that all people be treated fairly and that there be justice in our society. They can understand that, and that even in their lives, their daily lives, there'll be opportunities for them to take stands on the side of justice. You know, nowadays we have a problem in our schools with bullying. It's been on the news a lot and everything. This is one issue around which maybe children of this particular period might be able to draw parallels between themselves and Melody. Am I going to try to intervene when someone is being treated unfairly, or am I just going to stand on the sideline or whatever?
Mm.
The story, Denise Patrick, the writer, gives us so many instances in the story where the children have an opportunity to think about what's going on and to decide what stand they're going to take. And so I think the book will be valuable in that sense. The story also shows how important it is to speak with your parents, with elders, with other members of the community to test what it is you're thinking and letting them know what you're thinking so that you can get help. That's one of the key lessons in the book, that Melody relies on her community, her family and her larger community, and they help her grow.
Dr. Gloria House, Professor Emerita of African American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and Melody Ellison makes her official debut this coming Saturday in an event at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. And we should note, American Girl has donated $100,000 worth of the two books about Melody to all of Detroit's 22 library branches. Dr. House, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And now for our Thursday mailbag. Every week, host Lester Graham looks back at the week in Michigan politics as he talks with Susan Demas, editor and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican leader. It is that last part that compelled a listener named Thomas to send us an email, which reads in part, "I'm writing to you about having Ken Sikkema on your program regarding certain subjects. As I assume you know, Mr. Sikkema is a former Republican member of the Michigan legislature. This may not exclude him as a guest on many matters, but on strictly partisan political subjects, I don't think that he should appear on air without indicating his partisan background. Good point, Thomas. Our mentioning of his political background has been a regular, and we'll make sure to include it every Friday. Thank you so much for keeping us on our toes. If you've got a comment or a question, we would love to hear it. Send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer is Tony Brown. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.